are building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, friends, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio, the show that explores the power of active nonviolence. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Negler. Today is Friday, November 25th, and our show today is about sanctuary, and in particular, the history of sanctuary, what it means, and how one fits into a tradition in the creation of a peace history in particular, because sanctuary falls into that. And we're also going to be looking at the creation of, in activism today, the movement called Sanctuary Campuses. So in terms of creating a peace history where sanctuary is included in that, I'll be talking with Wendy Chmielewski, who is the curator of the Swarthmore College Peace Collection. And then in terms of the Sanctuary Campus movement and what we can do to get involved, I'll be talking with Elliot Young, who is a professor of history at Lewis and Clark College and also their director of ethnic studies. And he's author of several books on borderlands, migration, and transnational history, his most recent being Alien Nation. And for those of you who are regular listeners to Peace Paradigm Radio, we have a special announcement today that this is our last Peace Paradigm Radio show as such, where our show will be changing titles in December. So it's the same content, but a title that's closer to the heart of what we do, and it'll be called Nonviolence Radio. And we'll have a little bit of a new theme song, a little bit of a makeover, I guess you could say, but probably a good one where you get a haircut and people say, that looks like it's, you can actually see your eyes. You know, people, I think you'll appreciate the Nonviolence Radio as much as you appreciate Peace Paradigm Radio. So let's bring on our first guest, Wendy Chmielewski from the Swarthmore College Peace Collection. Welcome to Peace Paradigm Radio, Wendy.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here and to talk about this topic.
Yeah, and it's been, thank you for the work that you do in helping to curate a peace history. And this is very important work because one of the main questions that comes up in nonviolence is that, well, it's not based in science and there's no history of it. So can you speak to that at all about how one creates and curates a peace history?
Well, the Swarthmore College Peace Collection has been around for a very long time. It was first opened as such in 1935. They had hired their first curator. And it was basically a library at the time for the faculty and students of Swarthmore College, which is was at the time a Quaker institution near Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. But today we are open to the public with no charge, and we have literally millions of pieces of paper, hundreds of thousands of photographs, posters, bumper stickers, audiovisual kinds of recordings, digital files, all about non-governmental peace around the world.
You know, it sounds,
including, of course, nonviolence. It's heavily used by people from all over the world, both accessing through our website and actually coming to use some of the resources that we have. The materials that we have, besides being in all of these variety of formats, actually go back to the 17th century. So we do have publications about peace issues, work against war, work against standing armies and militias, conscientious objection, going back to the 1600s. Certainly part of the other resource at Swarthmore College are Quaker records, and of course Quakers have been very much involved in peace witness, creating peace, and social justice as well. So it's a huge topic, and the materials that we have are created by peace activists as individuals. So we have the papers of two of the women, the U.S. women who have been Nobel Peace Prize laureates, Jane Addams and Emily Greenwalch, as well as organizations like the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the War Resisters League, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, Code Pink, and many, many others. Literally hundreds of large collections, that is, all the records of a group or papers of a person like Adams, or parts of collections. So it's a wonderful resource, and it's available.
Yeah, it sounds pretty amazing, Wendy, because I've traveled to India just to visit, well, not just to visit, but part of the visit was visiting a peace museum about Mahatma Gandhi, and it was one of the most high-tech Gandhi museums, which was very interesting. But having gone to India and skipped over visiting the Swarthmore Peace Collection, it sounds like an extremely inspiring place. As we're talking about sanctuary today on our show, can you give us just a few resources that we might find at this in this peace collection at Swarthmore College?
Right. So the sanctuary movement, as we're, I think, thinking of it as a location where people need to feel safe. We do have materials going back through the 1980s, and these are resources from people mainly from Central America whose lives and cultures were disrupted by the covert wars fought by the U.S. In Central America in the 1980s, particularly in Nicaragua, but also El Salvador and Guatemala. So we have that material, and it's some of the material details how peace activists in the United States created these sanctuary spaces. But it also details there's information from the people themselves who were seeking sanctuary through in the United States and with the assistance of these organizations. But we also have material of refugees who were either forced out of their home country and came to the United States seeking relief from violence and war in their home countries, but also material of people within their own country. So, for example, we have the papers of a French Protestant minister and his wife, André and Magda Trocmé, who were living in a small village in part of France, and they, assisted by many, many people in their region, were rescuers of people trying to flee the Nazis during World War II. And it's a very well-known case. But we also have material from various peace activists who either attempted to or did leave Nazi Germany or parts of Europe that were invaded by the Nazis in that period. Helene Stocker, who was a German feminist and peace activist, who managed to come to the United States, but had first gone to Scandinavia and England as well. And not only people seeking refuge, but also their records. So, you know, Stocker was able to bring some of her papers, and the curator of the peace collection in the late 1930s, was able to go to Europe to not only help arrange for people to leave, but also that the records of peace organizations could leave Europe and come to the United States for safety. including the records of the Women's International League, which, of course, they thought were in danger at that time. So there's a lot of these stories, and also we just put some material up on our Facebook page last week about Japanese internment, the internment of Japanese Americans in the 1940s, of which we have some material as well, and which was fought against by peace activists at the time.
Wendy, thank you so much. I think that this collection in particular, it's just the same way that we're seeing the spread of the sanctuary campus movement. It would be so amazing that if those campuses also had a collection on peace history the way that Swarthmore does. But this a very special thing about the collection is that there's a subset that is available online that is currently being curated as well, called the Nonviolent Direct Action Database.
Yeah.
The Global Nonviolent Action Database. Can you say a few words about that before we wrap up?
Yes. Well, that's been started mainly by a peace activist who was also teaching at Swarthmore, George Lakey, very well known in the nonviolence action movement for many, many years. He's been an activist at least since the 1960s. And he had this idea of doing exactly what you have just talked about, which is that people don't necessarily know about the history of this movement and that there are sources available. So he's worked with students and other faculty have now taken on this project as George has retired, trying to create cases. I think that there are over 1,000 cases now from all over the world, from, you know, going back at least 2,000 or 3,000 years, giving this kind of history and making it available to people so that people are aware. And also the database allows people to compare some of these nonviolent actions around the world rather than just sort of picking one here and picking one from there. So it's a wonderful resource, both in not only showing that these actions took place, but also encouraging students to help create this history, and or at least create the record of it and bring it back into our common knowledge.
Great. Well, beautiful. And thank you so much for the work that you're doing in helping to create the peace history. And I'm talking right now with the curator of the Swarthmore College Peace Collection, Wendy Chmielewski. Thank you so much for joining us on Peace Paradigm Radio. And we hope to have you back when we're Nonviolence Radio in the future.
Great.
Thank you so much. Let's turn now to, we were just talking about the creation of a history, and now let's turn to the idea of creating history as we speak. And our next guest is Elliot Young, who is professor of history at Lewis and Clark College in Oregon, and he's the director of their ethnic studies program, the author of 3 books on borderlands, migration, and transnational history, the most recent being Alien Nation. Welcome to Peace Paradigm Radio, Elliot Young.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, thank you so much. People have been asking me when I, as the director of an organization for nonviolence called the Meta Center for Nonviolence, and people have been asking me, what can we do to help build sanctuary? And so that's why I wanted to make the show about the idea of sanctuary today, in particular, the movement that you are participating in called the Sanctuary Campuses. So, Elliot, let's start off with some sort of basic ideas to get people up to speed. So when there's discussion about sanctuary movements and sanctuary, what do they mean by that?
So there's a longer history to sanctuary, which goes back to the early Christians and then the Underground Railroad in the 19th century in the United States, and more recently, of course, the 1980s with Central Americans fleeing violence. But the sanctuary campus movement is, I think, distinct from some of these earlier movements in that people on campuses, students, faculty, staff, and alumni are asking that the universities and colleges not cooperate with federal immigration authorities when and if they come to deport students or other undocumented people on campus. But we're not asking, or no one to my knowledge is asking, that they break the law. So what we are saying is that the colleges and universities should not cooperate with these authorities unless ordered to do so by a court. And connected with that, we hope that if they have collected information about the immigration status of people on campus, students in particular, that before Trump takes office, that they destroy those databases so that if we were to receive a subpoena, the information wouldn't exist.
Elliot Young, can you talk a little bit more about the idea of why a campus as opposed to a town, and what would happen if folks who don't go to that college seek sanctuary on that campus as well? Would that help to offer sanctuary to them as well?
Yeah, so a college campus, whether it's a public university or a private university, is a space that is set apart. This has been recognized by the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency in a 2011 memo when they talked about sensitive spaces, which include churches, schools, hospitals, and university campuses. So I think there's an understanding that from the government and from ICE in particular that certain spaces in our society need to be treated differently and are more sensitive. And so the idea of the sanctuary is that people on the campus would be protected. Of course, if the immigration authorities or police had a court order, or if it's what they call an exigent situation, if there's a shooting on campus, they don't need a court order to come on. But barring that, we're asking that if they're coming to deport people on the campus, that the universities not cooperate unless they're forced to do so by a court.
And which universities are currently getting involved in this? Is this just one or two campuses, or are there more?
So there are over 100 universities and colleges across the nation that have petitions, which have gathered, you add them all up, hundreds of thousands of signatures. And there are over 20 schools that have issued statements, which basically get at the substance of non-cooperation with federal immigration authorities. And I think four schools which have officially declared themselves sanctuary schools, including two in Portland, Portland State University, Reed College, and Wesleyan University in Connecticut.
Elliot, hi, this is your colleague Michael Nagler speaking.
Hi.
Could you tell us a little more about the walkout that I understand happened, I think Wednesday last week? I think 80 campuses were involved nationwide.
Yeah, so there was a national call for a walkout. I know Portland State University participated in the walkout, and I think the idea was to call attention to the need to protect students and other undocumented people on our campuses. And this was at a moment, this has all been organized basically overnight since the election. Petitions started going out a couple of days after the election, and the idea, organized through social media, caught on like wildfire. And so there were, you know, within a week, over 100 of these petitions circulating. And I think the idea of the walkout was to raise public awareness about the issue of sanctuary, and also to try to put pressure on administrations to declare themselves sanctuary, or at least to issue a statement indicating what kind of protections they would offer to students. And so this movement is ongoing. It's been successful at more than 20 schools, but I think in the coming weeks we'll see many more college and university presidents issuing statements.
We're talking right now with Elliot Young, professor of history at Lewis and Clark College and director of their ethnic studies program, author of Alien Nation, about the Sanctuary Campus movement, for those of you just tuning in. Elliot, can you say a little bit more about what a Trump presidency or administration offers that is more of a threat than any other administration, or are we looking at a continuation of policies that have targeted undocumented people in the United States? And can you speak to that at all?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a longer history to U.S. immigration policy, deportation and deportation going back to the end of the 19th century with Chinese exclusion, through the 1930s with Mexican repatriation, where over a million Mexicans and Mexican Americans were pushed out of the United States. In the 1954, they had a program called Operation Wetback, in which more than a million Mexicans were also rounded up and pushed out of the United States. So it's part of that larger trajectory. Since the 1980s, deportations increased and incarceration of immigrants increased. And especially under Bill Clinton's presidency, there were a large number of removals. But more recently, of course, President Obama is the known as the deporter in chief, because more than 2.5 million immigrants were deported under his tenure as president. So in some ways, this is part of a larger continuum. The difference is now that with the Trump presidency, we have someone who has promised on his first day in office to end the DACA program, which was the program that Obama instituted to protect upwards of 750,000 students who arrived as children in this country from deportation, and to give them work permits to allow them to put themselves through college and become a full part of American society. So he's promised to end that program on the first day, and that makes them subject immediately to deportation proceedings and to removal of their work permits. So I think that that's different. The other aspect that's different is that the kind of people who he's appointed to his transition team include someone named Chris Korbach, who was the architect of the SB 1070 law in Arizona, which was basically, by their own admission, a way to make life intolerable for immigrants and Latinos in general in Arizona, so that they would self-deport. And in fact, after SB 1070, many immigrants left the state. They didn't necessarily leave to Mexico, but they left Arizona. So that now, that policy we can expect on a national level. We also have Jeff Sessions, who's the new nominee for Attorney General, who has a very harsh position on immigration. So what we're going to see is an increase, or what has been promised is an increase in deportations, an increase in incarceration of immigrants. And right after the election, a sign of this was that the private prison corporations, their stock price went up by 40%, because people who are watching this understand that this new administration will result in many more people in prison.
Elliot, I wanted to point out that people are trying to trace back the origins of this basic human response to protect, and they're neglecting to mention that the Greek poet Euripides wrote a play called Suppliant Women that was performed in 423 BC, and it was common practice in the ancient world that if you took refuge at an altar in a temple, that you, no matter what you had done, even if you had murdered someone, the relatives of the murdered person could not attack you in that location.
Yeah, so exactly. This goes way back to the ancient world. The difference, I think, between the sanctuary campuses is that, well, in the ancient world, of course, and medieval world, this was part of the legal exemption, sort of if you went into a church or a temple. What we're talking about is part of that tradition, but not part of the tradition in the 1980s, where church people basically did civil disobedience and refused to comply with the law, and many of them were brought to trial and convicted. I think that there's a little hesitancy on the part of institutions to take that next step from non-cooperation to civil disobedience.
We have a few minutes left on this very interesting interview. We're very grateful to have you on the show today, Elliot Young. Can we talk a little bit about some of the points of contention within the movement itself? You had mentioned to me that there's some contention around calling it, about talking about sanctuary in particular. Do you want to speak to that?
Yeah. So there, of the schools, the more than 20 schools who have issued statements, only three or four of them have used the sanctuary word and officially declared themselves sanctuaries. And some of the arguments against calling oneself a sanctuary campus is that it promises protection that the schools can't really provide. So that's one argument. The other argument is that it links or invokes this broader history from the 1980s and from the Underground Railroad of not complying with the law, of doing civil disobedience, which I think the schools are not willing to sort of officially subscribe to. So there is that argument that using sanctuary is misleading. My response to that is that we are defining sanctuary very clearly as non-cooperation, but not breaking the law, and that this idea has broad resonance within our society. It has got a long tradition back to the ancient world, as was mentioned, and people understand what this means, what they intuitively understand what sanctuary is as a humane response to people fleeing from, in this case, unjust laws. And so I think it's worthwhile hanging on to the concept and the word sanctuary.
Yeah. To me, it seems like such a surprise that people would want to distance themselves from the good work that happened in the Underground Railroad, for example.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be, and this is my message to our president, was this is an opportunity for, you know, our campus to lead in a long, illustrious tradition of standing up against unjust laws. And I think there's no one, you know, among the university college presidents who I've heard from who is against the deferred action for childhood arrivals. It's a broadly accepted policy, not only in academia, but I think among the American public. These are people who were brought to this country as children, speak English, are Americanized in whatever that means, but in the sense that they've grown up in the United States and they don't know any other country. So deporting them at this stage in their life to a country they don't know, to a place where they often don't speak the language, would be, in my mind, cruel and unusual punishment. And I think most Americans understand that, and so support this idea that this group of immigrants, especially, should be given sanctuary. But I'd also like to add that in addition to those DACA students, which is about 750,000, there are many family members of those students who I think similarly have a right to be in this country. And many of the staff people who are cleaning up the dorm rooms, cleaning up the classrooms in campuses across our country are also undocumented. So as we push for this this group of students who are in many ways a sympathetic group, we should also think about the other 11 plus million undocumented people who should have as many rights as these other students do.
And if people want to find out more and get involved, how can they do so? What do you think?
So there are a number of public places on the internet. There's a Sanctuary, hashtag Sanctuary Campus Facebook page, which I started, which is a public group. So if you go there, you could sign up, and people are posting news articles, petitions, discussing strategy. There's other Facebook groups. Some of them are closed. But there's just a lot of information being shared. And I would say in your local community, you could find out which schools have petitions already that are being organized. Join those efforts. If schools don't have petitions being organized, then one could organize those. There's also a map which has been created by a student at Pomona along with a grad student at Pennsylvania State University, which shows all of the colleges and universities that have petitions, as well as all of the statements. And so you could sort of zoom into your particular region and city and see which schools are involved. So if you go to that Facebook group, hashtag Sanctuary Campus, you'll find that map, and you could sort of link up with the local organizing efforts.
Thank you so much for joining us on our show today, Elliot Young. It's been very informative and inspirational in the way that it really, you gave us very concrete ideas and ways of getting involved and also a very clear grasp on what we're getting involved in.
Well, thanks for having me, and good luck with the show and the organizing.
Thank you.
Take care.
So that was Elliot Young, professor of history at Lewis and Clark College and director of the Ethnic Studies program there, author of three books on borderlands, migration, and transnational history, the most recent being Alien Nation. And before that, we had the curator of the Swarthmore College Peace Collection, Wendy Chmielewski, talking to us about the creation of peace history. So this has been a show about sanctuary. So stay tuned, and we're going to get into some more history in the making with our nonviolence in the news. You're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Negler. And we're going to turn now to the news, as well as a little bit more conversation on some of the nonviolent origins and ideas behind sanctuary. So welcome back to the show, Michael.
Thank you, Stephanie. I'd like to lead off with something rather personal and an image. Back in the late 1980s, I was in Germany, and I visited a monastery that had been started in the 17th century in a town called Dinklage. And the minute I got there, I realized I had seen that place before. And there was a photo. This was in the days before real virility and the social media. But there was a photo, and I realized it had been taken of the very nuns that I was visiting. The issue was that a Turkish family, which was undocumented in our terms, had taken refuge at the monastery, and the immigration police had come to get them and take them out. And the nuns in habit kneeled down in the road praying and blocked the police cars. And those police cars turned around, and that family was protected. So there is a long, long history of creating safe spaces, which are sacred in the sense that they protect human life. And there's a part of human life that transcends the laws that individuals make.
When you told that story, I was also reminded of a story from another hero in the nonviolence struggle, which Nirmala Deshpande, who there's a story about when she was in her village, there was some rumors of Hindu-Muslim rioting that was about to happen. So Muslims were fleeing because it was a majority Hindu village. And they didn't have a place to go, so they were actually hiding in individual homes of their friends who were Hindu. And when the mobs came, they knocked on people's doors. And then when they got to her door, they said, you know, we think you have a Muslim in there. And she really surprised them by saying, yeah, I do. And actually, the individual in her home was hiding under her altar. So you could see them in broad daylight. You didn't have to look around and find somebody. And so, but they were very surprised by her saying, yes, there is somebody in here. He said, well, you know, let us have him. And she said, no, you may not have this person. And if you try to enter, you'll have to kill me first. And they went away. And apparently this happened at house after house after house, the way that just individuals offering sanctuary was a powerful remedy to a fury, a frenzy of hatred that was spreading in the village, and that nonviolence was able to stand up to it. I think that that's something that we miss when we talk about when we start to fear violence happening. We forget how powerful nonviolence really is, because it can change the narrative and change the story in the middle of a conflict where somebody's expecting passivity or violence in return, and they get raw courage. What do you think, Michael?
I think that that was very well said, Stephanie. It actually spread not only, this was in Gujarat in 1992 when the present Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, had just become governor of that state just a few days before. And the riot was quite vicious. The mobs were coming in with gas canisters and whatnot. And not just, as you say, this woman's example was somehow picked up, even though we're not talking about communication, and it spread from village to village. And I've always used that as an example of what Kenneth Boulding calls integrative power. Mm-hmm. His definition of nonviolence is, I will be authentic and we will end up closer. And the authenticity is the woman after woman, calmly standing there and saying, yes, I am hiding a Muslim, often under their Hindu altar in their house. And then the next step, not saying, I'm going to prevent you from coming in, giving them back agency, but saying, if you want to come in here, you'll have to kill me first.
And I think that this part is also one of the missing dimensions of the conversation about creating sanctuary. Because if we're creating sanctuary, say, on our campuses, which our guest Elliot Young was just talking about, on the one hand, having the administration make a decision that there will be protection for undocumented students is one thing. But the student population also has to be behind it, so that when folks drive up and start harassing people who they suspect as being undocumented or different from their demographic in some way, and people are being harassed, that ordinary individuals also know how to intervene and step in. So sanctuary is about what we do as individuals as well as how we create the structures to work with that.
Very good point. And in a sense, you could say it's an appeal to a higher law in addition to whatever may be written into civil law about sanctuary spaces. And I'd like to read a little bit of a statement by one of the students who was part of the recent walkout. He said, his name is Saavedra, he said, we've been through pain before, and if we can stay serious and organized, we will figure this out. And he went on to say, if done right, this could be an opportunity to redefine the country. Mm. I think that's very important. I think many people feel that this is going to be the first flashpoint between the peace and justice world, so to speak, and the Trump presidency. This is going to be the first place where there's actual confrontation.
Well, there's a lot more that we could say on this subject, but there's also what we understand as we're creating nonviolent strategy to address the violence of our times in whatever form it comes up is that all of our issues have interrelatedness. Yeah. And so let's listen to some of the nonviolence happening in the world right now and see where we can draw those parallels and those connect the dots, I mean.
I'm going to, take up that challenge. I think that's a good idea. One of the things that people are keenly interested in right now, and I think it's a very, very good idea, is training. You know, in our roadmap scheme, when we originally published that, we proposed a couple of years be set aside for training and strategizing before people try to do anything. Well, we've been preempted, and I think with the new regime, there won't be that leisure period of a couple of years, but a lot of people are starting to come to the groups that have been traditionally offering trainings. And in fact, they're mostly swamped. Campaign Nonviolence has, as you know, a nonviolence training hub. We've mentioned that before, nonviolencetraininghub.org. And they were hoping to have 1,000 trainings in this year, 2016, and they're up to 723 as of yesterday. So they are struggling to keep up with the demand. And the Michigan State campus is particularly active because of Meta Peace Teams, originally called Michigan Peace Teams. And they have organized something called a nonviolent response to fear and hate. And then popularresistance.org is listing training resources on their calendar. That's popularresistance.org/calendar. And in particular, there is a very active program that's being organized by the Jewish Voice for Peace. It's called the Ready to Fight Training Series. And they have quite a few different resources. They have webinars that have been recorded and a major campaign is going to be starting, I believe, on the 2nd of next month. So for that, look at jewishvoiceforpeace.org/ready-to-fight. And we're going to try to collect some of these resources and have them also on our website, metacenter.org. Well, moving on to other issues, we started off the program talking about an aspect of peace research, the Swarthmore College Peace Collection and the Global Nonviolent Action Database. And there is a new resource in the world of nonviolence history, too. As you know, we in particular are very interested in what's called unarmed civilian peacekeeping or unarmed civilian protection, UCP. And there is a new database online in England. It's ucpresearch.org.uk. And so they have really quite a large collection of resources. It's a beautifully organized website. If we had more time, I'd tell you a whole bunch more about that, too. But if you may remember that when we started UCP, at least when the American group got started many years ago, one of the first things that we did, and I was, I think, the person who recommended it, was to look over the history of that type of activity, which was then called third-party nonviolent intervention, and to compile a list of cases so that we could see from that what are the best practices, what's to avoid and what's to do. And a woman from Germany, Christine Schweitzer, was asked to compile a database. She did a terrific job, which is a 70-page document, which Nonviolent Peace Force still has on their website. So that is a very active subfield, and I think a very important one, within the world of nonviolence that's been well documented since it began recently. So let me turn now to some of the other resources that are going around. There's a film Actually, kind of two films on this one. There's a documentary film called Desmond Doss, Conscientious Objector. It's about an American guy from Virginia who refused to carry a rifle and what happened to him and how he eventually was honored by President Truman with the Congressional Medal of Honor. He was the first conscientious objector ever to receive that honor. And his story, which is incredibly dramatic, the guy was just incredibly brave. At one point, he is being carried. He'd been very badly wounded, and he's being carried on a litter. But as they're getting him back to the camp, he sees another GI lying on the ground. This was somewhere in the Pacific Theater of Operations. I think it was Okinawa. Yeah, it was Okinawa. And he rolled off the litter and said, take that guy. You know, he needs it more than I do. Well, a feature film has been made out of it, which I recommend only with the greatest hesitation because it is actually a very violent film. It's called Hacksaw Ridge. If you write to me later and you say you took my advice and you didn't see that film, I will be pleased. As for documentaries, though, there's another one called, two more I want to mention, one called The Occupation of the American Mind, very important topic that we sometimes forget to look at, and that's being put out by the Media Education Foundation. And there's one that has won a prize at the Tribuca Documentary Film Festival called Do Not Resist, which is about the militarization of the police in this country. And I have to say, it is scary. You see people training these police officers and literally saying to them, we are at war, and you are in the front lines of that war. So we have become a nation that's at war with itself. And I will try not to dwell on this negative note. Let's turn to other resources. I always like to mention your book, Stephanie, Gandhi Searches for Truth, A Practical Biography for Children, which you're going to be parlaying into a whole peace curriculum for very young children. And I look upon you as a pioneer in that field. I don't think people are doing it a whole lot with children in that preschool age category. And it's going to be an extremely interesting and hopeful experiment. But a fellow author of yours who's also just brought out a book is a senator from Vermont. His name is Bernie Sanders, and his book is called Our Revolution. Big document, 450 pages. And I hope that that book is going to be a huge success. My original linguistic background is the same Brooklynese dialect as Bernie Sanders. Now, our good friend from Yes Magazine, managing editor Sarah Van Gelder, has written a very interesting book called The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America, which I think is going to be very, very useful. And a quote from her, the only way such a big revolution can happen is, ironically, at a small scale. This reminded me very much of a statement from someone that we like, Sally Gerner, a colleague at the University of North Carolina, who said the way to get big is to stay small and well-connected. We also have recently received an enormous, mighty volume called Mahatma, Gandhi's Life in Color, which comes from gandhiserve.org, and they have a website for the book. You look up Mahatma, The Life of Gandhi in Color. That website is mahatmabook.com/shop. It is basically a total immersion in the life of Mahatma Gandhi with colorized photographs. And I was dubious at first because I'm so familiar with the old black and white photos. I wasn't sure I wanted to see them in color, but it's so well done. And I don't think I was offended in the least little bit. It is extremely engrossing. I am not quite through looking through the whole book, but it's an amazing job of research and can amount, as I say, to a complete immersion in the life of Mahatma Gandhi. So moving on to some of the news items, I would like to mention, or quote rather, something from the famous Indian chief Crazy Horse. We are, of course, going to be talking now about the Standing Rock demonstration and the Mississippi Stand and others that go before it. And right now, as we speak, this is really local and really community radio. Right outside the studio, around the block, around the corner, there is a spontaneous demonstration in front of the Wells Fargo Bank. Wells Fargo is the fourth largest investor in the industry of a pipeline building, and to the tune of something like $500 million. So some of the good citizens of the home here of our mother station, KDOMR, are demonstrating on the main drag as we speak. And that's how they are celebrating Black Friday, and people are being called upon to do that around the country, to just stand in front of banks that invest in the equipment. There's another investment strategy afoot, also organized by Jewish Voice for Peace, and that one is against Hewlett-Packard, because it turns out that Hewlett-Packard provides a lot of the equipment that's being used to basically maintain the apartheid system in Israel-Palestine. So to see more about that, you can go to jvp.org. Now, let me read you something called The Last Prophecy of Crazy Horse. "Upon suffering beyond suffering," he wrote, "the Red Nation shall rise again, and it shall be a blessing for a sick world, a world filled with broken promises, selfishness, and separations, a world longing for light again. I see a time of seven generations when all the colors of mankind will gather under the sacred tree of life, and the whole earth will become one circle again. In that day, there will be those among the Lakota who will carry knowledge and understanding of unity among all living things, and the young white ones will come to those of my people and ask for this wisdom. I salute the light within your eyes, where the whole universe dwells. For when you are at that center within you, and I am at that place within me, we shall be as one. Mniwikoni, water is life."
For those of you just tuning in, this is Peace Paradigm Radio, and if the news sounds a little bit more interesting than some of the news you get on corporate media, it's because this is nonviolence in the news. So, Michael, you have a couple more minutes. What's your last news item?
Let's see. I think I mentioned that UCP has taken another big step forward at the United Nations, and I'd like to mention that the Interior Department this month announced an agreement with Devon Energy that resulted in the retirement, as they say, of 15 oil and gas leases encompassing more than 32,000 acres in a particular region called the Badger 2 Medicine region. And they said, "This is a landmark moment in the decades-long battle to protect this region, and future generations will be even more thankful for it than we are today." It's good to share some good news because, as we know, a young woman, 21-year-old Sophia Wilansky, was hit by a concussion grenade that she says was thrown right at her and is likely to lose her arm in that confrontation. And just to mention an event starting today, there's that week of boycott of Hewlett-Packard. And on December 4th, the third annual Howard Zinn Book Fair will take place in San Francisco. And don't forget the Million Women March. More on that in our next program.
Great. Thank you so much, Michael Negler, my news anchor here on Peace Paradigm Radio. That was Nonviolence in the News. Thank you to all of our listeners and our mother station, KWMR. If you'd like to have Peace Paradigm Radio, soon to be Nonviolence Radio, and your local station, just contact your local station and make that possible and share the show with your friends. Thanks to the Meta Center for Nonviolence and all our volunteers. And until the next time, everyone, take care of one another, and you don't need to go shopping today.